All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. And we're going to do things fast today because we got so much to jam in here. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an interview I did up at the Sundance Film Festival this year with Kim Longinato. And it's all about her new film, Dreamcatcher. And we'll be talking both with Kim Longinato, the director of the film, and Brenda Myers-Powell, the main character in the documentary. And it's both a very compelling story and a very, very moving film. So make sure you stick around for that one. You don't want to miss it. But opening the show up, I'm really, really pleased to be doing this segment because I really liked it a lot reading the book, and I really like the subject, and I really am looking forward to talking to this person. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Craig Stanford. Craig is the author of Planet Without Apes, in which he warns that the extinction of the great apes, chimpanzees, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans threatens to become a reality within just a few human generations. Craig, welcome to the show.
Hello, Michael.
Hello, Craig. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. It's good to talk with you. Let's jump into this right away. You opened the book up with exactly what I was just reading. You opened it up with the threat of extinction that's facing the great apes. What is the actual situation, and is it imminent? Is extinction imminent?
Well, you know, I guess the issue with the great apes is that we are inundated with conservation messages these days. I grew up with, and you probably grew up with, save the whales, save the rainforest, and now we're in a situation where so many things, biodiversity-wise, have to be saved. But the great apes are in critical trouble, and it's very possible that there are four great apes, the orangutan in Asia and the chimpanzee, bonobo, and gorilla in Africa. It's highly possible that at least two of those will cease to exist in the wild in our own lifetimes, not, you know, our grandchildren's lifetimes. So the situation is really quite critical right now.
You also raise that it's not just a question of just understanding that. And to me, it was really important that, you know, it kind of shocked me. And, you know, not because I know anything about, you know, the extent of the ape population and the great ape population. I actually learned quite a bit in reading your book. But the idea that this is sort of something that is going, that's sort of going along, but you also come out and talk about that we have to do something about this. But one of the things that we can't do is anthropomorphize the great apes, because that would actually operate to the deterrence of what we're trying to do in terms of stopping this extinction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we all know that it's easy to caricature these animals. Kids go to the zoo and look at them, and they're funny, and if they're having sex, their moms don't let them look, and they do all of these incredibly human-like things that, in one sense, should make them top of our list for animals to protect because of our obvious evolutionary connection. But there are so many species out there that people are worried about. And to be honest, some of the species that we worry about most, we worry about because they're glamour animals or they're beauty animals, meaning they're tigers, they're pandas. They're animals that evoke our emotional heartstrings in a way so strong. And I think sometimes the great apes don't always do that. And I also think there's an issue here of, you know, we're working in a lot of very, very poor countries. And as Western conservationists and biologists, we go into these very poor countries, and it's very hard sometimes not to come across as being kind of colonial. And we don't want to repeat all the colonial mistakes of the past where we go in and tell people in these impoverished countries what to do. We want to help them preserve their own natural heritage. And sometimes it's a fine line to walk.
Yeah, you know, but you also say this thing, which I guess it's related to what you're saying. You say that there's a real importance to understanding the apes on their own terms. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that it's so easy to look at these animals and kind of create a little cartoonish image of a chimp as almost an under-evolved person. But they're fundamentally different animals. They're also not exactly like what our ancestors were like. Of course, many anthropologists study the great apes because they provide lessons about what our ancestors were like 3, 4, 5, 6 million years ago, but they are their own species, and each one is unique, and we need to take them on their terms. We need to understand their individual biologies. What is a gorilla? What is a chimp? What are their habitat needs? What are their food needs? What are their psychological and emotional needs when we have them trapped in captivity, and then work from there?
And I just have to say this because I know it's just sitting in my brain and waiting to jump out. So I'm going to say it right now. When you're talking about how people look at these various apes and the different types of apes, one that really surprised me, I have a quick question to ask you because it made me think about this. The bonobos, you described them as pacifist, vegan, Kama Sutra experts. And I was wondering if actually some of those, is it possible that some of the people that I used to live with in 1969 migrated to the bonobo population?
Well, actually, what happened is that we've known about chimps. We've been studying chimps for a very long time. I mean, Jane Goodall's been out there for 55 years now, and many others who have followed in her path. Bonobos, which if you were to see them in a zoo next to a chimp, you might have a hard time telling them apart. They're very, very much like a chimp physically, but they have a very different society, a very different social behavior. And as you said, it's been actually tabloid news. You can actually read about them sometimes on the National Enquirer at the supermarket checkout because they engage in, they're very much more female empowered than chimps are. Female chimps are often brutalized by males in the, who are interested in sex and some political gains, whereas female bonobos form coalitions and alliances, and they do protect themselves against onslaughts by males. And then they are extremely sexual, at least in captivity. They're extremely sexual compared to most other animals. So people have looked at chimps and bonobos kind of as point counterpoint, kind of chimps are from Mars, bonobos are from Venus, for about the last 20 to 30 years. I've actually written articles saying that that's a bit hyped and overstated, you know, and it just plays so easily into our whole kind of talk show mentality of trying to find a point counterpoint. But the real thing about bonobos, for the purposes of the book that I wrote, is that they are more endangered than any of the other African apes. They live in war-torn Democratic Republic of Congo, which is not democratic or a republic, but we still allow them to call themselves that. And they live in forests where they are also eaten by local people, so they're in really terrible trouble.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit more, and I couldn't appreciate what you've just said more, man, because I thought exactly of that, and it stopped any flurry of ridiculous things I was going to say about the bonobos, because I was really moved by what I read in that, in terms of also how the difference is, the difference between the groupings of apes. Now, you talk about each of the four types of great apes are nations unto themselves. What's that mean, and why is it significant?
Well, I mean it in the sense that, you know, these are species. They have their own specific and particular ways. They also have a certain integrity. I'd like to call it really dignity, that when we destroy a forest in Africa, you know, when it's cut down by a Chinese logging team to provide lumber for the Far East, for instance, we're eliminating not just a gene pool of chimpanzees, we're also eliminating a culture, because these are one of the very few animals on Earth other than ourselves that use tools, they have technology, they have traditions that are passed from one generation to the next, not through their DNA, but through learning. So in terms of them being nations unto themselves, you know, these are creatures that have and that should have a really substantial moral ethical standing in the world that ought to prevent us from doing the stuff that we do to them.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stanford, author of Planet Without Apes. Now, Craig, one of the things when you were talking about this in terms of the significance of this, you also talk about the most pressing, and this is one of the things that got me, the most pressing threats. And the things that you listed were fairly pressing. And then there's also something that we'll get into a little bit later where you talk about, you know, sort of, well, how do we then approach this? But I wanted to actually look at this in terms of what do you see as the most pressing threat?
Yeah, you know, I just did a kind of a worldwide lecture tour last year, and I was amazed that a lot of people, even very well-read, enlightened people around the world, really aren't aware of some of the greatest environmental threats, not only to the great apes I'm writing about, but to other animals as well. But habitat loss, of course, is kind of the elephant in the room because it's not going away. People need land. Poor people in poor countries need farmland. They need places to find food for their families. That's a big problem that we have to work hard about and create national parks and sanctuaries while working with local people. I read about a couple of risks that people are generally not aware of in the U.S. One of them is the bushmeat crisis. Bushmeat is a term most people are not familiar with still. It refers to simply the meat of wild animals, and Americans in our early days of our history lived on bushmeat. You know, we're out hunting deer for food and not for sport. In Africa today, bushmeat means the meat of anything you can catch and kill and feed to your family to put some protein on the table, except in recent years, bushmeat is such a delicacy in many West and Central African countries and cultures that it's become an industry. So when you have a diaspora of, let's say, Nigerian people who move to other parts of the world, London, Brussels, New York, they take that desire for bushmeat with them. And so now we have a global smuggling network, which includes the meat of gorillas and chimps being sent, in usually as smoked meat, into other countries. And the impact is dramatically greater than it was when we were simply talking about people putting food on their family's table.
Yeah, that was a part that really sort of got to me, too. I was really wondering about that. You know, the other thing is you talk about disease, and that was kind of interesting to me in a certain sense, because you look at, like, the relationship between these apes and humans, and then you look at the question of disease and how, you know, what's the, you know, there's a lot of sort of things that you could be tempted to say, okay, they tie into one another. And in a way, there is some tie-in. It's in some places, but there's a lot more impact of disease than I actually ever thought in terms of, you know, what it's doing to the ape population.
Yeah, it's a huge issue, and it's funny because for so long people thought that when they were out in Africa somewhere, if they ran into a gorilla or a chimp, the danger was mainly from the animal to them. You know, they were going to be attacked, when ironically it's actually the other way around, that these animals are so closely related to us, they catch all of our diseases virtually. We pass diseases like the flu or tuberculosis to them as tourists, unintentionally ecotourists, who get too close. These days, ecotourists tend to wear a surgical mask, are required to prevent the transmission of unwanted diseases. And then you have the diseases that we hear an awful lot about in our media as though they were purely human diseases, like Ebola or anthrax, which actually are massive killers of the great apes. So until the past year, of course, Ebola was a disease that mainly was a Hollywood-hyped virus. It had breakouts in Africa that killed a few hundred people here, a few hundred people there. But until this year, where we had an outbreak that actually happened in a city, it really had never been a massively impactful disease on the human species. But it's been an impactful, terrible disease for great apes for a very long time. And we know that there have been many, many more gorillas and chimps killed by Ebola over the past, say, 20 years than humans have been killed. And it's just a disease that's out there. We still don't really know the reservoir of the disease or the vector of the disease. We do know that there are parts of the African forest where thousands of gorilla and chimp carcasses have been found killed by Ebola.
Mm. You know, and that question, the whole idea of disease also plays over into one of the biggest scourges that are operating against apes right now in terms of their use in laboratory experimentation and their use to sort of, you know, try and suss out how to deal with the disease that impacts mainly humans, but that these apes are basically infected with or going through horrendous treatment in laboratories for experimentation. And that's something, yeah, I thought you wrote very powerfully about.
Yeah, the history of primates in experimentation is, of course, a huge one. I don't think there's a drug out there that hasn't been tested before final FDA approval on monkeys, and they're still widely used in research with more restrictions than there were in the past, fortunately. But the great apes are now, have been in some countries and are being in the U.S. phased out of biomedical research. And ironically, one of the reasons for that, other than the obvious humane reasons that these are animals with the cognition and the emotions of a small child, and so making them into human-style pincushions and locking them in a tiny cage is just not morally acceptable. But it's also ironically true that chimps, despite their relatedness to us, really are not good models for many of the most common and important human diseases. So they make terrible models for studying AIDS. There are many chimps that have been infected with HIV in hopes that you could study the progression of the disease. And I believe only one or two of the hundreds ever actually developed AIDS. They also, chimps do not, by and large, are not subject to breast cancer or prostate cancer, which are two of the main killing cancers in our own species, of course. So ironically, they're kind of lousy models for some of the most important diseases that they've been caged up and infected with over the years.
And yet it continues. And to me, it's really interesting because you approach this from a way that is kind of unique, I think, or maybe it's just unique in that I haven't seen it very widely. But the idea that you talk about this thing about, well, why should we care what happens to the great apes, whether it's from the experimentation or to you know, the various things that are plaguing their ability to stay alive in their habitats. You know, you raise an issue that basically, well, why should we care at all? Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to me, the bottom line is a moral one, an ethical one. But I think it's a perfectly reasonable question for people to say, gee, there are so many causes in the world, so many human causes, so much poverty, so much death and starvation in the same countries where the apes live. Why should we be concerned about the great apes? And the best answer I can give is that these animals are the next in line from us. I mean, they are our closest kin, and we do have the ability to save them. That's a key issue here. We have it in our power to at least mitigate, if not stop, some of the many threats to their existence. And by not doing that, it's kind of functionally equivalent to saying, I have a cousin, he's dying of a disease, he can be saved with a certain amount of money, I have the money in my bank account, I'm just simply not willing to spend that money to save him. It's kind of that same level of thinking. And it's also easy for us to ignore the problem because we live in our affluent Western lives, and these guys are out in a forest somewhere in Africa where, for the most part, they're invisible. So, you know, I really feel like the most compelling reason is a moral one. People will write about, ecologists will write about, we need these animals to be functioning parts of functioning ecosystems, rainforests. They play an important role in rainforests. They disperse seeds that allow new trees to grow. But really, the bottom line for me is a moral one.
You know, you also raised the question, which I thought was very interesting, too, about whether apes should be granted legal rights. And you wrestle with that. I mean, it seems like you're really wrestling with that in terms of what they're up against in terms of all the experimentation, mistreatment, and all this stuff. But should they be granted legal rights? And then you also argued that, well, but we have to step back because we have to view the fate of an entire population that would override the rights of any one individual in terms of apes.
Yeah, there's kind of an interesting and sort of ironic debate that goes on in the community of people and scientists and ethicists who are trying to save these animals about the importance of the individual. So an animal rights advocate, and I, by the way, am very much an animal welfare advocate. I can't call myself really I'm certainly not on the same page as PETA and some of these more radical animal rights groups for a variety of reasons. But when we look at these animals as individuals and say we have to save this animal, I feel like that's far less important than a more ecological approach of saying we need to preserve this habitat where they live. We need to preserve these animals in the wild in perpetuity. So sometimes what's good for the habitat is not always good for the individual. And I would cite hunting as an example. I'm not a hunter. I don't really approve of hunting. However, it's simply a fact that can't be ignored that hunters provide a very large percentage of the funding for conservation work in the United States. They pay license fees and so forth. They want habitat preserved so they can go out and hunt, manage populations of animals. And you know what? It's not a very purist view, but for the long-term future of these animals to be preserved, it may be the only rational view that the population of animals and the habitat they live in just has to take priority for me over the welfare of any single individual animal. Although that sometimes is hard to argue. Now, Jane Goodall has always taken the view that she wants the governments of Africa to confiscate smuggled baby apes that are making their way to some laboratory or some zoo somewhere. And she cannot tell these governments to confiscate them and intercept smugglers unless she's willing to provide a home and a sanctuary for these babies, these orphan babies. So she really has always emphasized the individual for that reason. I'm not involved in those projects so much. I'm more worried about the future of ecosystems in which these animals live.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stanford, author of Planet Without Apes. Now, let me ask you this question. Again, it raises the question of anthropomorphism to me, and especially because there's a tendency to actually look at this in terms of, you look at apes, you look at the babies are cute, all the things you're saying about how when you look at them, you're thinking, wow, this is not that far removed from me. I've had the experience, you stand in a zoo and you look at a gorilla and you can stand and watch that gorilla for, you know, an hour. And it's just so mesmerizing. But, you know, there's a tendency, a pull, I think, to talk about apes and the fate of apes in anthropomorphic terms. And you raise a question related to that because you have a chapter in your book called Ethnocide. And I want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, ethnocide, if we were talking about people, refers to cultures being wiped out. You know, every single day, there is a human language that's on the verge of disappearing or is disappearing because of the influence of Westernization, because in some cases we've committed genocide on some indigenous people, and so they actually don't exist physically, therefore their culture has disappeared. When we talk about the great apes, when we talk about any other animal that's not a great ape, really, we talk about them as gene pools. We try to preserve those animals. But when we talk about the great apes, it's not only their physical selves we want to preserve, but they also have traditions. As I said earlier, they have ways of doing things. They have tools that they make, they manufacture, they pass those traditions from one generation to the next. And it is absolutely a comparable, if simpler, version of the technologies and the cultures and the traditions that we ourselves live by. And so to recognize that in another animal is, I think, a tremendously profound thing and something that we can't overlook when we talk about, well, should we really put these guys on a pedestal above the other animals out there, all of which need our help and our money and our energy to help protect them and their habitats? And my feeling has always been that these animals deserve some special status because of their humanness in some way.
Interesting. Yeah, it's very interesting. All right, one final question, Craig. And it's the last sort of chapter in your book, A Planet Without Apes, because it seems like what we entered into this discussion with, well, is it possible? Is it imminent? And it's a very dangerous, it's a very threatening situation right now. What would the result be, a planet without apes?
Well, first of all, I'd like to think that you could look at this two ways. We're on the verge of losing these species forever. Or you could look at it in a slightly more optimistic way, as I prefer to, which is to say that in the United States in the 1800s, we nearly lost all of our big animals. You know, the bison, the wolves, the mountain lion, the grizzly bear, and at the last hour, they were saved. So we have viable populations of all of them today with national parks in which they can live. I'd like to think Africa is going through the same process right now, that there's a terrible bottleneck going on in which forests are being decimated, the animals are being decimated, but we will, through our efforts as conservationists, working with local people and local governments, we will be able to preserve them. If we don't do that, then, of course, the natural heritage of these countries is lost. And it's hard for me to imagine a world in which we look not just at animals out there like a passenger pigeon or, you know, some of the other famous extinct animals around us, but something that's almost human, and say to our kids and our grandkids, yeah, we just didn't do what it takes to make sure they're around anymore. That would be just terribly, terribly sad.
I agree. And Craig Stanford, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Sure. Talk to you again soon, I hope, man. All right, take care. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Craig Stanford, the author of Planet Without Apes. And Craig is also a professor of biological sciences and anthropology and co-director of the Jane Goodall Research Center at the University of Southern California. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be getting ready to listen to the interview I did with Kim Longinato and Brenda Myers Powell about the film Dreamcatcher. Welcome back. That's Matthew Shipp with Cohesion, right? And Dreamcatcher, it's a film I saw at Sundance. It's a film by Kim Longinato, a British documentarian, and it's a vivid portrait of Brenda Myers Powell, a former prostitute who helps women and young girls break the cycle of sexual abuse and exploitation. I'm not going to say any more. I'm just going to let you go right into the interview now. So enjoy. Kim Longinato, welcome to the show.
Hello.
And Brenda Myers Powell.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm
welcome.
Good.
It's really good to have you here, too.
Thank you.
Okay. I saw the film last night, Dreamcatcher, and I went to it, and I have to tell you, it knocked me back in my seat. It was very powerful. It just really knocked me back in my seat. So I wanted you to give people a synopsis of the film, just what it's about and how you found the story and what compelled you to do this story.
Well, that's two questions. The first one about what the film's about, that is fascinating because what I think it's about is probably very different to what other people think. You know, we all think it's about different things. I think it's about, in a way, it's like a family is like a microcosm for a society and a community and then a community for society. I think it's about all the secrets and lies and balance of power and all the things that we've all learned to live with and all the taboos that we don't talk about, and how it's in America and it's in England and it's everywhere. And I think it's about those things, but it's also about the power of somebody who starts with very, very little and kind of transforms herself to become a pioneer and to become a force for change in her community. And I think what I hope the film will do is inspire. I mean, obviously we can't, lots of our stories aren't as emotional and as dramatic as Brenda's, but we can take from her, from Brenda, and actually feel the strength to change our own lives. That life is a constantly evolving process, and there's all sorts of things that we're all changing, and that we're not one fixed thing, we're changing all the time. That's what I see the film about. So it's like a kind of very, very edgy boyhood.
Brenda, this is the film, the story. What is it to you?
It is about secrets. It's about how secrets can actually destroy you. And why do people have a need to hold secrets when they know it's tearing a life apart? And it's about someone who has stopped being under all the secrets and decides to open her life like a book because she was basically in bondage of secrets. You know, secrets kept her out there on the streets. Secrets kept her in the company of the wrong people. So why would we continue the secrets? And then it's about hope. Hope that a society will stop allowing these type of secrets to continue so that little girls and little boys can grow up to be stronger and more trusting and loving and have hope and have that light inside of them shine instead of it being covered up by all the secrets and the damage and the craziness that they have to deal with on a daily basis. And they're not the kind of kids who get therapy, who can go and get the type of professional help. They have to deal with it in the best way they can, through anger, through drugs, through all types of self-mutilation, cutting, all types of things, and prostitution. Why does it happen in our community? Why is it continuing to happen in these communities? And it seems to be okay, and people want you to suck it up, but it's nothing that can be sucked through a straw.
I completely love that answer. I think that is a wise answer. And I think it's also about what it means to be male and female and how we're redefining those things. So you have a man who admits to having been abused, and you know, we know that a lot of girls are abused, but there's a man who's abused and how he took that and changed it, and all about violence, mm-hmm. and how the main man in the film splits himself into two people, which I think a lot of men do. That's not unusual. Mm-hmm. I see Brenda as a lion, that in old-fashioned cultures you would call Brenda, she'd have the word masculine, which is the opposite. She's the most female. She's fearless on the streets. Mm-hmm. She's doing really dangerous things. She's fearless. But what she's most fearless about, and what has changed my life meeting Brenda, is she's most fearless about being honest about her past. These are things that nobody talks about. And there's going to be a lot of people saying, Brenda, how can you talk about these things? And she will say, because they were eating me up. You know, and you can see how it goes down through generations. Not just big lies like being abused, little lies like, you know, how we dominate each other emotionally. It's everything in our lives are about power and us.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Kim Longinato. Kim is the director of the documentary film Dreamcatcher, and Brenda Meyer's pal, who was the main character in that film.
Let me ask you this, because we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves on this, in a certain sense, because the stuff you're saying is very powerful. But people need to know actually what the film is about.
Can you tell them?
Huh? Okay. I can tell them. Yeah,
actually,
I can tell
this
them.
Is interesting because I would really like to know what the film was about for you.
For me, the film was about this grotesque inequity in the world that has existed for time immemorial, since the beginning of power relationships in society, particularly focused around women, and since the beginning of when women have been forced into a mm-hmm. subservient mm-hmm. position. And
yes.
Then it goes all the way through, and you get to this era in the world, you get to the era of capitalism, and it takes in, it incorporates the oppression of women, but it then magnifies it and distorts it into even, you know, more grotesque forms and more deadly forms in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. And Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, made this point. And he said, you look at all these beautiful children who are born and are born female, and then you think about what is going to happen to them in their lives simply because of their gender, mm-hmm. how they were born, you know, the degradation, the demeaning, the suffering, the rape, the abuse, the fact that the most loved and trusted ones in your life oftentimes become the ones that hurt you the most, mm-hmm. not just mentally but physically as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so to me it was about someone who came out of all of that and said, no, I'm not going to allow this one to break me, but I'm not going to allow it to break anybody else either. So that's what I thought the film was about.
That is fabulous. But also,
we
like that.
Well, in our society, we seem to have a distorted vision of who we want to forgive. We want to forgive pedophiles. We want to forgive priests. We want to forgive everybody except someone who has been labeled as the lowest and people who are not worth saving. And before this whole thing became an issue with human trafficking put behind it, prostitutes were in that category. Prostitutes were like not worth saving. They were women who were damaged goods, who were unworthy of. They had a lifestyle. Other women didn't walk on the same side of the street with them. The only time men wanted to approach them was late at night. So we became a part of our own community and made our own rules. And these rules were dominated by the pimps, by the men. So we had our own territory, not because we wanted this, but because your society, the regular society, didn't want to deal with us. Now the society has turned around and wants to rescue us, but they don't even know who we are because we've built this world and created this life. And they want to try to help, but they don't have the tools. So that's why it takes women like me, people who are like me, to go back in that world and pull people out.
At the same time, I think, look, that's really true in terms of the women on the bottom of society. This is how women are viewed, and their lives are often forced to be like that. I mean, because everything comes at you, whether it's drug addiction, whether it's the fear, because sort of overall it has an impact on men and their mental health and all this other stuff, but it's also something that they do. They do adopt the dominating position in relation to women, and they mirror the broader social relations in the society where you have the people who run the society who come down press everybody else, and that gets mirrored and concentrated in the relationship between pimps and women who have been enslaved by them, basically.
And Johns who picked them up.
Yeah, I was just going to say
the
that.
Same
exactly.
Thing.
Absolutely, exactly. You know, here's the thing is that in your story, and I want people to get just a hint of your story because I know it comes out in the film, but in your story, you had to make a decision that this was not going to happen anymore for you personally.
Right.
So let's talk about that a little, because I think that was very important, and very important for people to know how that happened.
It was a process. It wasn't just an overnight overwhelming thing, but what started it was my last interaction with the streets was with a Caucasian white man in a Mercedes Benz. I'd always considered myself being safe with that type, that category of Johns, because they didn't want no trouble. They wanted to come get their business taken care of and go back to the suburbs and leave me alone. And I wanted to leave him alone. But it was different this time. This guy came to beat up a girl, and I was the one that got in a car. And he was beating me so brutally, even after he had paid me. And getting out the car, my clothes caught hold to the door. He had started up the car and was revving off, but he drugged me 6 blocks and tore all the skin off my face and my body. Now, if that wasn't enough, I was in shock walking around my community for about an hour bleeding, and people were just looking at me. And it was a kid, a little kid that drove up on her bike and handed me a roll of toilet paper and said, "You messed up." I went to the hospital. Somebody came by and had a sense enough to take me to the hospital. And this is, I guess, when the journey started for me to turn around. I entered the county hospital expecting to get help and services. They put me on a gurney, rushed me into the emergency room, pulled the curtain. The nurse came and they started to look in and see what was going on with me. The police came because I was so messed, beat up, but the policeman knew me. And he pulled the curtain, and him and the nurse were talking about me as if I didn't exist. They said, "She's nothing but a hooker," he told her. "She probably took some poor guy's money, and he beat her up," as if I didn't deserve to be attended to, because even if that was the case. She laughed, they giggled, they went away. When she came back, there was a guy who pushed me back into the hallway, and they left me there. And I was no more an emergency because I was a prostitute. I sat there until the second shift. I didn't even know how much damage was done to me until I had to go to the bathroom. And that's where I got frightened. After I looked at my face and saw the eyelid was almost torn and my face was gone. And I began to cry. And I said, "God, these people don't care about me. They don't care if I live or die." I said, "You need to help me. You need to help me right now, because these people don't care about me." And I laid down and I wanted to die on that gurney. But a lady came in, a lady doctor, and she like, "Why has she been here for a whole shift? Her injuries are extensive. Who did this?" She pushed me into the ER. They hooked me up. They started to work on me, and she admitted me. And I stayed in the hospital for 5 days. And I got a connection with that doctor who didn't ever say anything to me about my prostitution or who I was. And she just talked about, you know, our conversations. She would say at the end, "You're intelligent. You're smart. You're a pretty girl." And I couldn't understand. She would tell me that, and I would cry up under the bandages because I wasn't pretty anymore. And I didn't think I probably would ever be. And when she released me, she told me to go and see social services. And social services was a crock too, because they thought very little of prostitutes. And I remembered a number and a woman that had talked to me in jail, and I called that number and I was accepted into that program. That program saved my life. Though when I walked in the house of the program, what really made me stay is that there was an ex-prostitute there sitting at the desk that I knew. And I said, "Hey, where you been?" Which gave me comfort to know that this was another prostitute that I knew from the streets. I knew she was really, you know, I knew her pimp, I knew everything. And she started telling me how she got there. And I wasn't convinced, but I was comfortable. So I started to get comfortable. And within a few weeks, I was convinced that I needed to stay there and that they wanted me there. See, this is the difference. They actually wanted me there. I used to leave the house to go to the doctor and come back. And I used to be looking at the clock like, somebody's expecting me to be at dinner. I've got to go home. I hadn't said that in 25 years. This is what they made me feel like. I needed to go home. And even though how horrible my face looked, my other sisters, former prostitutes, didn't judge me. They embraced me. They kissed me on my scars. And they said, "We love you." So I stayed in this house and I got rebuilt. And I learned how to help others get rebuilt. And that's what they taught me, how to reach out to others after this has happened to me. And it was through an amazing woman named Edwina Gately, who is now my mother, like a play mom to me, but she's a real mom. She treats me like a real daughter, and she's from the UK. And she's still my mom. And if she hears this, "Hi, Mom, I love you."
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Kim Longinato. Kim is the director of the documentary film Dreamcatcher, and Brenda Meyer's pal, who was the main character in that film.
Now tell me this, because you went from where you're talking about you were, and it's a very moving story, but what makes it even more compelling and moving is that you went from there to now you play a similar role to all these young women.
Absolutely. So I learned that through her. And I also had an Aunt Susie who taught me how to be a lady, because I always looked at her as the epitome of lady. You know, she was something else. She still is. I used to be very like, everything was okay. I was getting myself together. And I got a lot of things quick. I got a job. I got my GED. I got a job. I got an apartment. I got a car. I negotiated a new car on my own. I didn't need anyone to go with me. You know, all these things that a man had to do this with you. You know, I felt really good about myself. I'm beginning to feel real good. I'm reading self-help books, and I'm going to breathing classes and yoga, and I'm learning how to be this wonderful woman. But there was something inside of me that was missing. So I started volunteering at shelters with women. And then I started doing a prayer thing to God and asking him what was the next step. And the next step just seemed right, to go and work with the women in the street. And I didn't know how to get connected with that, so I just started going and answering people who asked for volunteers. And I would work all day. He said, "Well, why do you do that?" I said, "Because my job pays my bills, but this work pays my spirit." And that's when the hole or whatever started to get filled up with the work that I was doing with the women and the way that I could talk to them and everything. And then all of a sudden, people started noticing what I was doing, and then they start calling me and, "We got a job, you know, if you want to take this on." They didn't pay any money, but social services doesn't pay any money. But the job, you know, I could pay my bills and do what I liked. And I did that. And I was doing it. I decided to be the face of prostitution because I had got my face back. I didn't think God saved it for me not to, you know, show it off. Kind of like that. "Thank you for my face. Here I go. What do you want me to do with this?" Women get out of prostitution, they don't talk about it. They don't want anyone to know about it. They don't want that man who wants to marry them to know that they had done this. I was not that woman. I needed to talk about it. I needed to pull other women out of their shells so they could talk about it, so they could heal. So I became the face for it. And I knew that was what I was going to do. And I talked to my daughters and they said, that's your story, Mommy. You go tell your story. And I've been doing it ever since.
And that's how Dreamcatcher was formed?
Dreamcatcher was formed between two women who met in treatment, Stephanie Daniels Wilson and myself. We met in treatment, and we said that we were going to do something else. We were going to be like worldwomen.com or something. But it just seemed right after I started working in this, and she went and got her master's in social work, and we came together and did this. So that's how that came together. You know, I've had people tell me, you need to stop telling your story. And I look at them and I said, you need to get a story. It's not professional for you to tell your story now that you're an executive director. But if I don't tell my story, how would another girl know out there that she can be an executive director? How would she know that now that she's standing on a corner or she's under control of some guy, but she can look at him and say, one day I'm going to be an executive director, you know?
That's what's special about Brenda is that she's true to herself, and that's really unusual, that she's become this woman. She's got a car, she's got a kid, she lives in the suburbs. You know, she's become a respectable, what we like to call respectable person.
A vote.
And yet she's true to her past, and she's proud of her past because she's proud of how she's got to where she is. And that is what's very, very unusual as well. Because these secrets and these lies and all these things that are in all of us and in our families, on all levels, all the way up, they eat away at you and they damage you and they make you less of a person. And what Brenda's doing all the time is she's building other people up, and in doing it, she's becoming a bigger and bigger person herself. She's becoming more lion-like and more. And that's what she's done for me, you know.
Now, how did you find out about Dreamcatcher?
Through Lisa Stevens, through the producer. She told me about Brenda, and that she's been trying for ages and ages to make a film about her, and she couldn't get the money. And I think she thought that if I was part of it, you know, I think she needed somebody to be part of this, so it'd be easier for her to raise the money. I think that it really helped. She didn't know me. You know, we met through making this film. And I felt in a way really lucky that Brenda and Lisa had come into my life and been asked to do it. It's been such a privilege, you know. It's been a huge thing for me. It's changed my life.
In what ways?
I think it's made me think, a bit like a woman said to me last night. She came up to me from the audience and she said, I'm going to go home and I'm going to change my life. And I said, how? And she said, I'm not beaten up at home. Nobody lays a finger on me. Nothing happens to me. But actually, I've got very low self-esteem. And if Brenda can turn her life around, I can. And that's what Brenda's made me feel. I mean, she didn't tell me the details of it, but she went out with her head up. So I think how it's changed my life is I've always believed in the power of change, but it's really made me believe in it more. Because everything in our society, in our culture, in the way we're always told, things don't really change. You can't change things. You know, that's how things stay the same. But Brenda's taught me that actually really, really bad things can become really good. She's like an image of that. She's valuing what's happened to her in a way and turning it around. Just what she said. She's using everything bad to happen to her that happened to her as a way of helping other people. That's pretty mega, really. It's huge.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Kim Longinato. Kim is the director of the documentary film Dreamcatcher, and Brenda Meyer's pal, who was the main character in that film.
Brenda, what I saw in the film from the very beginning, the way you spoke with the women that you were speaking to, it wasn't condescending. It wasn't, oh, I'm going to help you do this, I'm going to help you do that. And the most important thing I thought was that actually you kept emphasizing, and all through the film, this is not your fault. And in the world today, women get raped. They get raped on campus.
Absolutely.
and they're told it's your fault. It's what you wore, you know, all this other stuff that it's your fault. But you've been very, very strong.
Very strong, because I remember thinking that it was my fault. Thinking because I was a little girl who had a big butt, men looked at me and it was my fault because I had that. I matured early. Everything was my fault. If I hadn't have been sitting on his lap, it was my fault. If I couldn't be a kid, I could never be a kid. I was always not a kid. Was that my fault? having to have more responsibility than I couldn't even take on. No, it wasn't my fault. Was it my fault that my grandmother was an alcoholic? No, it wasn't my fault. Was it my fault because my mother died and I had to be in different places that affected me differently and that things happened to me that shouldn't have happened to me? No, that wasn't my fault. These girls, it's not their fault that mommy doesn't believe me, that I don't have support in my family. You know, it takes a village to raise a child. And then to be believed is the most amazing thing. And not to have to take the blame for such an adult action, for such a horrific crime, for actually being enslaved. How could you take the responsibility for that? The responsibility is not on yours. It's on a society in whole that keeps allowing these things to happen and trying to put a pink bow on it when it does happen. Let's go to Vegas and where prostitution on the outskirts of Vegas and it seems on the inside of Vegas is legal, but let's arrest her in another city or state. You know, what are you gonna do here? Is it going to be something that is going to be a form of legality, or are you going to persecute when you feel like it? Because everyone is got their own opinions, and that's what we know that they'll have in this film, their own opinions. But it's not your fault. The fault has been here for many centuries, as you said in the beginning, because males feel like they are prevalent over females, you know. And this is also an issue with young boys too, you know, but it's just about power and control and demand, supply and demand, and how it's abused to the utmost with human beings. You know, that they call me also in my town the Harriet Tubman of human trafficking. I kind of like that because I liked Harriet Tubman. You know, she was a gangster. I love her. You know, she took on some stuff that, wow, amazing things. And that's why my challenge is I take one day at a time, and I accept the challenges because you have to be fearless in order to forgive yourself, forgive those who harmed you, and then take that and use it to help other people. You can't be bitter. You can't be caught up in what did happen.
But you do have to be very firm in your conviction that you're right in what you're saying now. And what you said last night, you said, look, I didn't make the decisions to do this. You know, it wasn't like you were sitting there saying, oh, I can be a prostitute, I can be a teacher. Mm-hmm. Actually, you didn't bring the people in from the suburbs. You didn't enslave people. And I wanted you to talk about two things. One is you use the term enslavement a lot. And I think it's really important for people to understand why that is. And then I wanted to ask you again about this. It's not your fault, because they always say you make the decisions that determine the course of your life. And, mm-hmm. and you know, you look at someone who's living the life that you were living from a very young age, and any decision you made was actually circumscribed by the conditions you were living in. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't. There was nothing else there for you. You lived the life that you were born into, but you had to fight to not be killed by that, to not be eaten by that. So
absolutely.
Let's talk about that.
It was hard. It was hard. Everywhere you looked, there was predators. I remember going back to school after having my kids, and it was in a night school because I worked at a hot dog stand in the daytime to help buy my baby's milk and stuff like that. And I remember that high school GED teacher pulled me and let everybody leave the class and pulled me up to the side. And he grabbed my hand and he put his finger in it, moving it around very seductively. And he was telling me I didn't have to worry about my GED as long as I act right. And he was a horrible, bumpy face looking man. I looked at him and I was so disgusted, and he made my skin crawl. And I never went back to get my GED because I couldn't go back there. Those are the type of circumstances that you have to live through, that you feel abused. You feel like somebody just urinated on you after that happens. And then you have to get through that without support, and you have to process that through the best way you can. These are the type of things that we do on a daily basis, and the issues that we follow and come to us, you know, men talking to us as if we're garbage. You know what I'm saying? And we don't matter. And then we have to process that to feel better or to stand up so I can get up the next day and put my makeup on and look in the mirror and tell myself I'm beautiful, because I don't look like a fashion model. And I may be kind of pudgy, or I may be kind of full figured, but I'm beautiful. But I don't get that attention. I have to give that attention to myself. We have to go through so much to be who we are. I don't know what it is to be a man because I've never been a man, but I definitely know what it is to be a woman, and I know what it is to pull myself out of a barrel and try to stay above that hole so that I can stay outside the hole and persevere. I never thought that I wouldn't, but I know it was so many girls that were out there hopeless that just didn't have that peace, you know. What was I to do? Leave her in the gutter? No. No. It wouldn't have been cool.
And we'll just have two more questions. This is the one about enslavement, because you've used that so many times, and I think it's really appropriate and really important that people understand what you mean and why you say enslavement.
It's an act against human nature to enslave a woman and make her prostitute her body for the services for another person to gain money, okay? And then all kinds of rights are taken from her. The right to choose, the right to be anything that she is. We take human rights away when we enslave women in human trafficking. Domestic violence is an act against human rights. When a man financially abuses a woman, and the economic piece, the control piece, where you can't do what you want to do in a society that says you're free, but you're not free in your own home, or you're not free if you're under pimp control. And then for another person to walk up and open his wallet and say, I can buy you, and look at you as if you're a piece of merchandise, look you up and down, and decide that he wants to have you come in his car or come in a hotel room with you, and you're a stranger, and do an act that is supposed to be so beautiful and personal, but here I am doing it with you and I don't even know you, but you think you have the right because you paid me money, and you, for those little 15 or 30 minutes, you own me as if I was a slave, and you expect for me to perform as one. So when I say it's an act against human nature, it is. I thought that we had got rid of that, but here we are now in 2015 facing the very same issues that our forefathers fought for. So how is it not an act of slavery?
Kim, I have to ask you one more question, which is, you, and it's very hard after this because I'm listening and I'm thinking it's so powerful and so true. And you, the last film that I saw of yours was Selma.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually was very similar in a certain sense.
It is, yeah.
It was a film about a young
Muslim
woman. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fact that you watched her life,
mm-hmm.
but you were talking with her when she was over that.
Mm.
And she had gone on to social success and all this other stuff. But the similarities between Selma's story and the oppression of women.
Different continent.
Yeah, can we talk about that, how that hit?
I think the similarities between Brenda and Selma. Selma wanted to be a poet and wanted to do something with her life, and yet she was locked up in a little room. And exactly what Brenda just said, which I thought was just amazing, what she just said about those women in that village as slaves. They are. As soon as they reach puberty, they have to belong to a man. That's the only way it can be. So they have to get married as soon as they reach puberty. They have to be kept in the house until they're married. So they're being seen as merchandise that can't be damaged. They mustn't be damaged. They must be kept intact. They must be kept virgin. And the way you do that is keeping them in the house. And then they're passed on to another man. So the transaction is between father and husband. And that's why I'm so excited about same-sex marriage. Because the way that heterosexual marriage, and it's been done in a way that people just accept. I mean, even the words behind it, the father gives the daughter away to the husband in the church. And that has always really shocked me, and you can cover it up any way you want, but that is what is happening. The father walks with the daughter down the aisle and hands him over. So the woman is like a merchandise. It becomes clear. We have to change all of these things. See, what's so interesting is that what we call normal, you know, we say, oh, Brenda's unusual. And when you actually look at what's normal, a man handing a woman over to the husband, you realise that we take for granted so much. And once you start exploring what it is to be a female, when we can all get to that point where we can see each other, we're not looking in terms of gender. We have to redefine everything. That's why I love meeting people like Selma and people like Brenda, because they're redefining their whole cultures.
Brenda, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kim, thank you once again. Really enjoyed talking
thank
to you.
Thank you.
All right, welcome back. That was Kim Longinato and Brenda Myers Powell from the movie Dreamcatcher. All right, this brings us to the end of yet another show. And before we go, there's something I want to talk with you about. You know, if you've listened to this show on a regular basis, you know that I'm a supporter of Bob Avakian. And you also know that last November, I was very much involved in promoting a dialogue between Bob Avakian and Cornel West. And it happened in Riverside Church in New York City. And now that dialogue has just been made into a feature film. It's a really, really powerful film. It's about a four-hour film, and it just takes you on an incredible journey. And the name of the film is Revolution and Religion, The Fight for Emancipation and the Role of Religion, a dialogue between Cornel West and Bob Avakian. And the premieres are occurring in the following cities on March 28th. In New York, Los Angeles, Berkeley, Houston, Chicago, and Atlanta. At 10 o'clock on that same night, there's going to be the online launch of this film. And you can access that online launch at 10 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on March 28th by going to www.revcom.us. Spread the word far and wide, brothers and sisters, so tens of thousands can watch this thing online. And if you're in a city that's anywhere near the cities where it's premiering, again, it's New York, Los Angeles, Berkeley, Houston, Chicago, and Atlanta, make sure you get out to see it and bring everybody you know, because again, it not only will change your life, it's going to help change the world, all right? And on a final note with regard to this film, go to revcom.us, all right? That's revcom.us, and you'll be able to see the trailer for the film, plus a couple of really mind-blowing clips about the film, give you a good sense of what it's all about, and you'll be able to follow up on where it's playing, when it's playing, and the rest of that. So that's revcom.us to get all the information you need about this film and about changing the world. So get there or be square. I just couldn't avoid saying that. First, I want to thank all of our guests today, Craig Stanford, Kim Longinato, and Brenda Myers Powell. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Kiana Turner, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out now with Lou Reed's cover of Devo's What a Wonderful World. Talk to you again next week.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of the people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies crying, I watch them grow. They'll learn much more than I'll ever know. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.